Hey, Perf Bites listeners, before you get started with today's episode, please pay attention to this message from our sponsor.
Whether you want to load test your APIs or your browser-based applications, you need to be able to easily scale up volume and identify problem areas. SmartBear has you covered. Load UI is the rock star of API load testing. Using an intuitive, versatile design, Load UI gives you the power to scale up and out, letting you dial up high volume and real-world load from any number of local and remote computers, all within a single test environment. With Load UI, it's easy to create and configure tests incorporating all of your OS, application, and database statistics agentlessly. It's fully interactive too, so you can easily modify your tests and fix errors on the fly. Load Complete is an astonishingly easy-to-use load testing tool for HTML, AJAX, and rich internet applications. Create and run automated load tests in minutes using a browser to naturally record your interactions with your website or app. You can scale up the number of virtual users, pull in data from Excel and other sources, monitor server resources during test execution, and even distribute your tests geographically. Reports and charts make it a breeze to explore aspects of how your site or app performs under pressure and ultimately pinpoint performance issues proactively. Load UI and Load Complete by SmartBear. Ensure outstanding performance across your entire web stack.
Time for Perf Bites.
What the f*** is Perf Bites?
The fourth square meal of the day. Don't bogart the Perf Bites.
Waffles. Microwave ready.
Add nutritional value to your brain.
It's time for Perf Bites with your hosts Mark Tomlinson, James Pulley, and Howard Chorney.
Perf Bites.
Whatever.
Hey, whatever. It's time for Perf Bites. And welcome once again, Perf Biters, to this late-night episode of the Perf Bites podcast with your on-demand, file-based download, low-jitter hosts, Howard, James, and Mark. Howard, how are you? Did we lose
Howard? Howard?
Where did Howard go?
I'm back. I lost you.
Yeah, it's weird. If that happens again, you can just, it's fine. Howard, how are you?
I think we had a buffering problem with Howard.
We probably lost a UDP. A packet section there or something.
Yeah, and since it was UDP, it didn't give a rat's patoot if it got to me or not, as long as it got sent.
And I didn't know it had a rat's patoot to offer, even if it did want to give one.
Well, you know, kind of UDP and rat's patoot sort of sound similar sideways anyways, but I'm sitting here in Los Angeles in beautiful El Segundo.
Yes, exactly. And James, you're in the Perf Bites Southern Command.
I am.
Yes, it's a little late, but it's appropriate that we're experiencing this live audio stream between three very disparate locations, where tonight our subject, we're going to cross the streams in the subject of streaming performance. And guys, now I know cross the streams usually means Ghostbusters, which is fine, but we're not talking about Ghostbusters, and we're not talking about the time that your older cousins dared you to go over to the electric fence on your grandparents' farm and take a pee on the wire. We're talking about video streaming, live video streaming, streaming protocols, audio, and of course, porn.
Yeah, because Mark, we do need to admit that porn actually drives a lot of these technologies on the internet. Whether people want to admit it or not, it's true.
Yeah.
And in the case of streaming, it is very true.
It's very true. Howard.
They're just in denial, that's all, that people aren't streaming porn. It probably is the biggest streaming industry out there.
It is. They actually invented some of the modern day techniques and the way we measure things, not in terms of porn. I know there's a whole different set of metrics for actual pornography. But the infrastructures and James on the News of the Damned, we talked a few times about some of the content, adult content that have brought down websites and things like that. These guys are actually some of the best in the industry for infrastructures doing streaming. So for lack of a better term around porn, let's just jump right in the deep end. Let's talk about streaming. James, you did some homework here, so maybe kick us off with people who have never really gotten into, they've done load testing in the web, but they've never load tested or done performance analysis in streaming. What is streaming? Really?
So streaming really comes in a couple different flavors. There's the live flavor. You know, so I have a live radio show or a television show or a event going on. And then I have like on demand, or then I have archive. And you can take it down to like, I have a radio stream, which is on, I don't know, iHeartRadio. That's a radio station. You know, we're on iHeartRadio as an on demand, but there are live radio stations on iHeartRadio. And then you have a player like a Vudu, as an example, which is video on demand.
Yep.
And then you have an archival type service, which is YouTube. Yep. And each one of these uses different technologies to kind of ship out the stream.
So
to
you can do that Vudu that you do so well.
Exactly.
Yes. Howard, I love you for that comment.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And so Vudu is like HD streaming, but yeah, AM/FM over a radio frequency is actually a form of streaming, although it's not digital, it's analog. And like TV, correct. TV would be an analog stream. There's a source that has power, and the wavelengths that are sent out over radio frequencies actually are real-time sent out as a stream. You can sort of do the same thing with digital content on the internet, and it's instead of waves, they really become like packets, and it becomes like a stream of packets.
And instead of a frequency, you've got a particular protocol that you use. In the case of live streaming today, most of that content is done using a real-time streaming protocol, RTSP, mm-hmm. real-time messaging protocol, or in the case of archived content, like on YouTube, it's actually just an HTTP request and downloading a file.
Yeah.
Now, Mark, you said Microsoft also has a special variant.
Do they download the file as a TCP file, or do they just download it as a UDP file?
Actually, it's for YouTube, it's just downloaded straight over HTTP.
Yep, put in the buffer.
Yep.
Yeah, put in like your web cache, little parts of the file. A podcast is a good example, right? People are listening to this episode right now. It probably downloaded a file, and it's playing it, but you can pretty much turn off the Wi-Fi network connection or the whatever network connection you have, you go in airplane mode and still listen to this podcast offline. In fact, you'll see a lot of the podcast, Stitcher has it, iTunes has it, whether it'll do, you know, save for offline listening. And there is, as you point out, James, there's a difference between just sort of receiving a file kind of in real time and playing it. And we'll talk more about sort of the sequence of, you know, playing too fast or not streaming fast enough, and actually real-time packet streaming. The one you mentioned, James, I also found, you know, when I was working at Mercury, we brought out the support for real networks, right? So the real player, and that was using RTSP. And then Microsoft also has the Windows Media Server or the Windows Media Platform. That one had its own sort of Windows special implementation of the Windows Media streaming protocol. Again, that one is also over HTTP. WMSP is over HTTP. And then RTMP, I think, is also something you find in Adobe's implementations, right, James? So Flash can obviously pull several different streams with the Adobe Player or the Flash Player, right?
It is. And Flash is really built to address a challenge prior to HTML5, of how do you control the streaming at the client? How do you have a known client? Well, I build a branded Flash player for, say, my radio station. I start it up, and then it streams across the internet using RTMP embedded in Flash. And then I get a kind of a quasi-live stream. And for HTML5, however, we have a built-in audio and video streaming player. So, you know, a lot of that technology is going to change as we move to HTML5. Now, Mark, you were also looking at something on the WebSockets front that people are, you know, doing kind of a quasi stream in that case.
Well, it's this WebSockets implementation, right? So this you and I both talked about LightStreamer, really kind of a cool. It's a cool platform. They're very easy to build, client and servers, lots of different plugins. So you can actually send the WebSocket over almost any type of protocol you want, whether it's, you can even send it over like SMTP, excuse me, HTTP. You can make an RPC request. You can just do really, you know, your own sort of socket implementation. WebSockets is sort of a layer on top that allows you to move data of any kind. That data could be audio and video, but I've also seen it in a lot of financial or real-time data streaming for like monitoring, graphing things. The same kind of infrastructure you'd see within, say, real-time Splunk or real-time Graphite kind of real-time streaming of data. Think of a ticker in the financial sector where it's just constantly receiving data and displaying it.
So any of your display tools, any of your APM display tools that are up there on the video monitors and your data centers are probably using WebSockets to get that data.
Yeah, because you hit one of the big things to understand is you hit a limitation on a polling where let's say you do have some of the older APM tools that maybe they go ask the server for, you know, if you're in Dynatrace, for instance, there's a sampling like every 10 seconds update the dashlet in Dynatrace or HP's world. You know, let's give me a 3 to 5 second or a 5 second update. And it's actually polling from the client to the server. The nice thing with the WebSockets anyway is that it's a push. So you open up your connection and the client just sits there and says, whenever you're going to ask me back some more data, I'll just bring it on in. So the whole idea with the limitation on a polling type of architecture is that once you move a whole bunch of data, you can't move it down the wire fast enough until the next interval comes. So you can't grow the data you're moving. Whereas with the push architecture, you can grow that, and then as much as your infrastructure can handle, then you just throw more infrastructure at it. You don't really have to rebuild the app to do that.
I also wanted to mention, you were talking about the APM tools. If you look at Sosta's Impulse, and have you ever seen the screens?
Globe? Very sexy graphics.
Very, very, very sexy.
Yeah, so, I mean, we're probably using WebSockets to do that.
That's your homework, Howard. Go figure out what the heck those guys are.
It's kind of funny. I was at an Impulse class all weekend this weekend. I just did not even think to figure out how we were actually getting the data over.
You know, Howard, I'm not a smoker, but every time I see Impulse, I have to go get a cigarette afterwards.
All right.
I know it is hot.
Yeah. So at the basis of someone getting started in streaming performance, as James, as we point out, there's just a different set of protocols. And in some cases, it could be on top of good old HTTP or something totally brand new like WebSockets. But that's going to change how you get into building tests because you have to really understand that these protocols are different than good old web or they're not in the GUI layer or they're not, you know, like ODBC or something. They're a different set of protocols. And I think even in the HP world, you had a separate bundle of protocols that were all the streaming bundle. Before we go too much further, James, let's talk about these different architectures or at least the choices. When somebody goes to implement, like let's say you've been testing websites for 2 years and suddenly somebody taps you on the shoulder and says, hey, come and test this streaming site. What is the architecturally, like it's a whole new landscape for a new engineer.
It is. So if you think of a traditional client server model, everything is point to point. That is, I have a client making a request to a server. The server handles my session and it hands something down uniquely to me. Now, we can have that model in the streaming universe. That is, it's called unicast. It's point to point. I make a request and then I subscribe to the stream and it comes to me and I'm being serviced for that stream. However, that's very inefficient. This is actually the model that the first Victoria's Secret fashion show used.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, you have an online streaming program of a bunch of beautiful women, and you have an internet full of socially dysfunctional men. What do you think is going to happen? You have a whole bunch of men at work connecting unicast-wise to these streaming servers, and they fall down. I mean, literally, yes. I think they fell over. They started smoking, spewing green acrid goo and everything.
So shouldn't they have been working instead?
Exactly.
So these were customers completely unrelated to the IT department at Victoria's Secret, but they really enjoyed that point-to-point contact with the Victoria's Secret model, I think.
That's probably the most point-to-point contact they've ever had as a social interaction. So the following year, the Victoria's Secret fashion show switched to what's called multicast, which is essentially broadcasting on a channel.
Yeah.
And you broadcast to a particular address. It's not unlike broadcasting to channel 8 on your television, or, you know, 132.4 on your digital television,
or an FM AM FM radio station. You exactly. Tune the dial to what channel they're on, and then you're receiving that channel. Yeah.
And then essentially you subscribe to the stream at that point. Right. It's a much more efficient propagation method. But your network has to be built to handle that. You have to eliminate a lot of duplicate routes in your network. So you could have some problems inside your local infrastructure for a multicasted stream. So Howard, I think you had something here.
I was just talking about, you know, multicasting isn't just for video, you know, for people watching video or whatever. Multicasting is used in a lot of the safety, a lot of the transportation industry we're in right now, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Right? I remember going on a site in South Carolina, James. I think we met for dinner that when I was there yep. that week.
Yeah.
And they were doing a lot of they actually ran the rails. So they had the multicast system for all the trains, all the freight trains. Yeah, so it's kind of interesting testing in there.
Very cool. So you have this choice, unicast being inefficient and inefficient, and multicast being much more efficient. If you have 10,000 people as clients, you would need 10,000 individual sockets or ports opened up on the server. With multicast, you don't need that. So the origin servers become more efficient, but there's still people, James, that host, you know, an entire farm of origin servers for those origin streams. They can be on-premise. If you start putting them all over the cloud, you know, things get more interesting. If you look at the way YouTube's architecture when they do live broadcasting of stuff, they use a bunch of repeaters. And then I think the question comes, and maybe Howard, you want to think about like testing in production or testing streaming sites in production where they've got a CDN involved. So if you've got repeaters and CDNs, is that you've really got maybe one small origin, but you're sort of sharing it out into this grid of distribution.
Yeah. And the nice thing too, well, once you start getting out there too, I mean, the whole idea of getting out in the CDN is you can actually start caching your content, right? So you can start delivering it out to everybody to watch more on a local basis. So,
yeah. Now in that case, James, I think you were saying you may have a unicast distribution into the CDN. The CDN then actually turns around, chunks that file up, and streams it over or blasts it out or broadcasts it out over multicast.
That is correct. You can have either direction in that case, but you're building efficiencies by using the CDN layer for the session management. So you can either use the CDN as the multicast layer, or you can use it as the unicast layer, but you're taking all that primary load off of your initial distribution servers. And if you look at, say, a YouTube or a Vudu, they have all their content on pretty much in a CDN. They're in the cloud. It's all CDN enabled. So if you get you know, the cutest cat video in the universe on an on-demand basis, you know, you're probably requesting out of the CDN layer instead of anything else once people start viewing it.
Yeah. Now there's also people, we should make a difference here, because I still get questions on like load runner for SIP or load runner for chat sessions that are bi-directional. The majority of streaming infrastructures, especially multicast, are unidirectional, which means you can optimize the network for sending and actually get all the buffers set up so that it sends stuff really quickly. And you really don't worry too much about things coming back upstream, right?
Well, there's one exception to this, which is voice over IP, because you do have streaming involved bidirectionally for this solution. So the same type of challenges that you have for unicast streams, you have for voice over IP, for call quality, session management, because it's all point to point. You have SIP that sets up the session, and then you have, a real-time streaming protocol, which is going back and forth between the two handsets.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about some attributes, Howard, of, you know, if somebody's really wants to understand the quality or characteristics of a stream, one of the biggest ones that you hear people talk about is measuring jitter.
Yeah, so, jitter.
Yeah, what is jitter?
Well, jitter is actually fluctuation in latency, okay, between point A and point B. And so what happens during that fluctuation is packets will actually get mixed up and be delivered of order. Jitter is the result of out of order
packets. Yeah. Now, out of order packets in other protocols is not that big a deal, right? You're like static content on a web page or just, you know, messaging or emails, you know, so it's because it's not real time, instantaneous kind of experience. Whereas a stream, you get two or three packets that don't show up right. Arrival rate isn't quite perfect or it's a little out of order. To re-request that stream means you have to like stop the whole stream. Hey, everybody stop, go back and give me those packets. And that can be very disruptive. And suddenly your stream is hello.
And Mark, that takes you right to that second attribute of these streams is each of these packets really has a limited life.
Yeah.
So if I get something out of stream, I'm not going to re-request it. I'm just going to discard it and I'm going to go on.
Yeah. So you might just drop some frame out of the video or drop a little bit out of the audio, and hopefully the end user doesn't really catch it. And actually, back in the early days of sample rates and the way these infrastructures were sending streams, they would just drop them. The client would just drop them and keep on going. So a real measure of quality and performance for the stream was, are you dropping frames or dropping packets?
Because basically when the server sends the stream, it's set it, forget it, right?
Yeah. Now, in a modern-day player, whether it's a live stream or even an offline on-demand stream from a file, another thing you can think about is having to restart that stream. So if you've ever played YouTube and all of a sudden it stops, like it spins, you see a little spinner going on YouTube, and then it has to wait for enough of those packets to download to sort of resume playing, and oftentimes it doesn't even resume playing. So what you'll see is the little gear, like in the YouTube player, you can either have it be, you know, you can select a lower bit rate, so you actually don't require as much data, the quality goes down, or it's actually dynamic. You can have it be on auto, so it auto, if you've got great bandwidth and great network speed, you get high quality, almost HD, but if your network bandwidth is awful, the player will automatically notch itself down and take a lower bit rate. So the multi-bitrate source was a huge thing as an attribute when you have a stream, have different clients at different stuff. Which brings me to the next point, Howard, is buffering.
Buffer, baby, buffer.
So what is buffering?
So buffering is actually storing enough data up before you actually release it or play it or display it. So it gets enough content going.
The YouTube player is a great example of buffering. You'll see it actually start to download data before it starts playing.
And we'll talk a little bit more about when you're testing stuff and what the performance is to hopefully you're downloading faster than you're playing so that you don't ever get, caught without some packets to play.
Like my rant a little while ago on News of the Dam because Amazon was pissing me off.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly the same. So you bring up a good example in YouTube. We have that a couple times. People ask, is YouTube streaming? And the answer is, if it's a live broadcast, yes, it's a stream. And it's not something you can download and listen to offline. It's a live stream. If it's on demand, well, James, I think the argument is, the end user's experience might be they don't really know the difference whether it is or is not a stream, but architecturally underneath, offline, it's a file. Yeah,
it's just a file request. Yeah,
exactly. Now, Perfbytes streaming, same kind of thing. If we do a live broadcast through Spreaker, and I hit the stop button in the middle of an STPCon live broadcast, the packets stop flowing, so the stream is dead. Same thing, live shows. But if you're listening to a podcast offline, we're going to post this and you guys are listening to it, it's a file download. So you got to be aware of what context you're in at your company as to what that is. James, we talked a little bit about HTML5, in terms of the video players and stuff that folks see. But this is where things are changing from a proprietary client away from that, and it's just going to be something that the browser spec supports.
Exactly. So HTML5 supports some new native data types. Of course, it supports MP3, MP4 for playback. It also supports H.264, which is a codec for video streaming, usually out of video conferencing, although it's used for live video streaming, and another one called WebM. So there's no special client required in this case. It is simply referencing the video object, and the browser with HTML5 knows how to take care of setting up a player to render this stuff.
Yeah.
And this is going to eliminate a lot of that Flash proprietary infrastructure that is out there.
Yeah.
Well, that is unless you still have an AOL browser.
Or, I mean, Silverlight's another good example. Flash, Silverlight.
Yeah.
You know, Adobe's has its own piece. In the Linux world, you know, there's other different media client pieces that you could put in there. People used to run Java applets, you know, to actually play video back. But now you've got Node.js apps that are running full JavaScript, and the players run in full JavaScript natively in the browser. It's very slick. And of course, the optimizations we'll talk about next. We'll take a little break from our sponsor here and then come back and talk about specific measurements for streaming performance.
LightSquare.com is a proud sponsor of Perf Bytes. LightSquare is a unique offering for performance tuning as a service for web architectures. LightSquare delivers tuning recommendations in under 72 hours without the typical investment in tools, license fees, or consultants, where we do the work up front. With LightSquare, you only pay based upon the level of improvement. Find out more about LightSquare's unique pricing model at litesquare.com/pricing.
Yeah, LightSquare. Awesome.
I like those guys.
Lightsaber,
that's right.
Yeah. We cut those web servers down to size.
Just slice them in half like some sort of a strange alien's arm in the bar scene. He doesn't like you. He don't like you either.
Apologies to our audience. Mark is having a Star Wars flashback.
Going somewhere solo?
I was. Han shot first. I saw it. I'm in slow-mo. I believe it. Yeah. Anyway.
So Mark, let's circle back to this topic. Okay, we've kind of grounded the technology a little bit. We've talked about protocols. We've talked about interfaces. We talked about unicast versus multicast. How do we measure this sucker?
Well, James, I think no matter where you go in performance, there's one thing you can never not measure. Response time.
Well, how do you measure the response time on a stream?
Well, in the HTTP world, like even in HTML world, one of the things that was measured sort of mechanically was this time to first byte. And to some extent, that applies in a mechanical sense. Now, it has nothing to do with, in a normal web page, you would say time to first byte, but it could take 100 bytes or 100,000 bytes just to render something that's visible on the page for the user to interact with, be it an image, the frames, whatever is being drawn, whether it's a web page or not. You know, if the client doesn't exist, you have to render the whole thing. So the time to first byte was always argued as kind of an incomplete view of the user experience, but it was a mechanical, technical way of determining whether there was latency to that time to first byte. It was more of a diagnostic than it was about the user experience.
So again, this is where I think that regardless if you're using HTML5 or whatever, the user at the end of the other side, there's going to be a lot of variables going on there.
Yeah. So
time to first byte, it could be fine for... We could be equidistant from the server. It could be fine for you and horrible for me because I happen to pay for better pipe.
Well, it tells you something different. So time to first frame in the video or time to first bit for audio, those could be equivalents in the streaming, but they have the same scrutiny. It serves as a diagnostic on the ability of the server side and the network to deliver that first byte. So it only tells you a little bit about what's going on. So that's why I wouldn't rely solely on time to first frame or time to first bit, time to the beginning of the stream. Those first acts start coming back. That's only one part of the diagnostic. I think there's a lot more to looking at response time because it's really the experience of the stream starts playing. And then let's talk about one of the other ones we look at is, can we maintain a stream without jitter? So if we...
And you know what, Mark? Anyone who's ever watched a video coming off the internet, particularly one of the main streaming services, Amazon, Netflix, Vudu,
yeah.
and you've reached a point where the player says, you know what, I can't play at this resolution. How about I play at a different resolution for you?
Yeah, you downgrade.
You downgrade. So that's the concept of jitter and bandwidth coming into play here.
And, you know, talking about that too, when you, I don't know if you've ever noticed, but on Amazon, or I haven't noticed it on Netflix personally, but you'll actually see it checking the speed. It knows how fast or slow to deliver the content.
At the beginning of the, before it even starts streaming.
Before it even starts streaming, it's basically negotiating the speed it needs to go at to deliver content at.
Yeah. So the experience of, just like a web page, if you've got a very rich and dynamic website, it's downloading lots of extra parts. It's obviously render some JavaScript, execute the JavaScript, display something to the user. At any point, if the network goes away or the stream gets disrupted, then you end up having poor quality of some kind. That could, Howard, it could be latency causing that. It could be like connection infrastructure on the back end where it just can't open enough connections, like their unicast.
Yeah, like when I was whining about Amazon before, if I was watching at 5 p.m, everything was beautiful. When I was watching at 8 p.m, it got really frustrating because there was just a larger demand on the server to get the content out, right?
Yeah, and so your time to first byte or time to first frame may be an indication that I can't even get the stream started, so something in infrastructure can't even get going. But James, as we talk about these sort of dynamic upgrade, downgrade, how else can we measure, you know, how would an end user really measure the quality of a stream in terms of
Some of this harkens back to, oddly enough, telephone call quality.
Really?
There's a standard from the International Telecommunications Union called Mean Opinion Score. So for true streaming going back and forth, it's a measurement of dropouts, call quality, things of that nature. And there's an actual document that says how you measure mean opinion score on a stream.
Wow. So is this, you should be familiar with it. I've never seen this built into any test tool, but it gives you the
These are more common for like VoIP testing tools and things of that nature. And I'm actually shocked that Mercury and then HP never took advantage of the mean opinion score.
Yeah,
model.
It's the app deck of screaming.
We don't talk about that A word here.
Yeah, exactly. App decks. I was going to say there's a couple other, like let's say you are testing YouTube. One good thing or a player like that, if it's going to do that dynamic upgrade downgrade, how long does it take the player to determine that it should change? So if it's running crappy for 5 minutes. And it really should be downgrading in order to keep the stream going. Well, you've pissed off your end user, like for 5 minutes. Maybe it would be better if the little client side said, you know what, in the first 30 seconds, if this thing's not good, I'm going to restart the stream and post a little message to the user that says, hang on, we're rebuffering to give you a better quality. Sometimes you see that on Netflix and Vudu and the streaming ones. They get the user experience is better. But for file downloads, where you're doing a podcast, I know I'm about to get on a plane or I'm about to leave the house. You know, all these settings on only download files or podcasts or videos when I'm connected to Wi-Fi. And so I'm like, how long does it take me to download that entire podcast? It's 50 meg. You know, I can't do it.
I'm going to say the pipe size word again. It all depends on, you know, what kind of a pipe you have at where you are.
Yeah. And the availability of a network connection.
That always is an important thing.
Right? I mean, of like a Wi-Fi network connection. If you switch over to 4G or LTE, maybe the way you have your settings on your device or your laptop, it wouldn't actually download that data. Because honestly, like our podcasts, the longer podcasts, they can be 50, 60 meg. And if you're downloading a video, good Lord, it could be a gig. So, you know, it could be huge.
Not to be funny, but I think I've downloaded some things faster on 4G than I have in some hotel Wi-Fis.
There you go. No. Insults to the good Mormon people.
No, because of my status, I get the upgraded stuff for free now.
There you go. That's good. So the other thing, James, about response time I would throw out there is this idea to avoid buffering, to avoid the delay, so that if you can keep the pace of downloading faster than the replay speed. You can't always control what the end user does, you know, with the stream, whether they jump around, forward, you know, that kind of stuff. You have to restart it. But one thing that most people will say is, if I'm just trying to watch the video and I can't download it fast enough to my client, and this is usually always some sort of network limitation in between, that's a bad user experience. So measure that.
Well, it's not always the bad user experience, Mark. And, and you can adjust the throttling on the server for how fast people can download material that's archived.
Sure.
And for instance, you see this on YouTube. YouTube is a file server. It's serving videos as a file format. But if you look at what's happening, the player will actually start playing before the entire file is downloaded. And the file does not download instantaneously, as you might think another data type would. Yep. It buffers, and then it plays, and it buffers, then it plays. And the argument is that you want to be able to download the file faster than the duration of the video.
Yeah. So where are we, in fantasy land at Disney or something? We're all going to get that? That's why we need buffering.
well, you've got the whole issue of demand during certain times of day. You do have the potential. You can overload a YouTube node or a YouTube caching node.
Yep.
So you do have these constraints that you have to work within, and buffering is there, at least in the video player, to try and address some of these network vagaries.
Yeah, exactly.
That occur.
Honestly, I think where we are today from a technology perspective, and I'm not saying I'm an expert in this technology at all, but there's probably room for improvement, because I think just with the technology we have today, we're always going to be seeing these issues. We can test for it, which is good, because we need to make sure we're serving things out the way we need to. But honestly, with the technology, I'm just not sure how much better we're going to get today.
Well, Howard, it brings up a good point generally about performance whenever we talk about improved resource capacity. So if we double the speed of a processor, there's a non-performance-minded architect or developer who's just going to presume that they can chew up all that resource. And this is in gaming and porn. Where it's like, well, hey, now why would I stream low bit rate when I can, look, I got all this bandwidth, I'm going to chew it up. So it's that old metaphor of, if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile.
I hate to say it, I'm going to bring in net neutrality into this.
Sure.
For streaming, for true streaming, where we have time critical and time to live on our frames, it sure would be nice if you could prioritize in a network the delivery of those packets.
Yeah.
But I do think net neutrality, at least in the internet, puts that at risk for that ability to prioritize one traffic type over another. And that applies to VoIP as a streaming solution, as well as in any other.
Don't get me going.
We could chat for hours on this one.
Well, debating it is valid, except for, I think while we're debating it over the course of the last 3-5 years, the reality of net neutrality or any type of prioritization scheme within a network topology just becomes self-evident. People are going to use more Netflix, or they're not. I don't think it's right to punish a perfectly good business that's delivering a perfectly good service by running when they're running on very open internet-based infrastructures.
This is all about prioritization. It's not, you know, whether one provider gets more bandwidth than another or preferred service. There are certain packets which have a shorter life.
Yeah.
And IP version 6 even has a quality of service piece built into it to address specifically the streaming items for voice over IP. And it's unknown, I think, on the net neutrality side exactly how that's going to address this, since the edict is no prioritization of any packet over any other. Yeah. And that is a concern from a streaming media perspective.
It is, especially as we see more and more media rich internet content on every page, on every mobile app, and all this stuff. You know, it's just, like I'm saying, it'll stop being a special thing And if everything switches to be media, then net neutrality kind of negates itself because, yeah, well, we're all doing streaming. Now the packets have changed.
But you do know on private, networks, you can prioritize your packet in your data.
Yeah,
you too. Can,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's just when you hit that border gateway that, you know, it's free range at that point.
And quasi-public infrastructure of the open internet.
Well, it is open internet, sure. And it should stay that way.
Yes. I'm all for openness and equality. But when it comes to buffering, we bring this back to our streaming, what we're talking about. Your playback, of course, is faster. You may have, James, that common ailment, especially for older streaming infrastructures. You could have a weak stream, and then you would need to give your streaming server FlowMax.
I'm sure this is a conversation you had with your physician, Mark, but I don't understand it.
Yeah. No, actually, I talked with my network administrator about it.
Oh, okay.
And what did they recommend?
Just a larger frame size, dynamic windowing.
Again, maybe if the pipe size is a little bigger, then the stream would be better.
Hey, now.
I know is that, you know, the little blue pill doesn't solve network performance problems.
It doesn't. It doesn't. Absolutely not. And especially when we're talking about porn infrastructure, actually being very innovative, we should talk about it. Anyway,
maybe you should just be using Cialis for everything.
I don't see.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is what you get for, you know, a midnight recording of Perf Bytes.
A late night recording of Perf Bytes at midnight, which is pretty awesome. Anyway, a lot of what we talk about in terms of even packet prioritization, as James points out with net neutrality, it is the highly sensitive arrival rate and ordering that's really, really important. Where if you look at these podcasts or even YouTube model, where you're trying to deliver a file and not a stream in real time, sort of that changes things, right? That changes how things get arrived. It changes the sensitivity for the ability for somebody to watch a video offline. And of course, if you've looked around you in your municipalities or on your airplane, barely are we ever offline anymore. So as that grows, that also changes the topology for streaming any kind of content in a real fashion. We're going to take a pause here for a public service announcement, and I'm going to wet my whistle with some water. And then we'll come back and talk about actual testing and optimization for streaming.
Hi, honey. I'm home.
Hey, you don't sound too good. What's up?
Yeah, not 100% today. My boss says I'm not performing at my peak today.
Not performing at your peak? Feeling like you're a website that crashes on a daily basis? Perhaps you need to tune your system up in the morning with a hearty breakfast. The best way to tune your system is to start the morning off with a heaping helping of Perf Bytes cereal. Perf Bytes is the cereal for the adult on the go. Perf Bytes are a little bit of performance goodness with the flavor of a wonderful single malt scotch that will get you up and running to start your day. Perf Bytes contains 100% of your daily FDA nutritional requirements. Plus, it packs the punch of a single malt to make your day even more enjoyable. Just add some ice and woohoo, you're ready to go. Heck, even if you're having a sluggish day after the first bowl of Perf Bytes, just have a couple of extra bowls and you won't care about the rest of your day anyway.
Hi, honey, I'm home.
Did you have a better day today?
Heck yeah, give me another bowl of those Perf Bytes.
Perf Bytes, the official cereal of Mark and James. And if you're a teetotaler like Howard, try the new Perf Bytes Light. All the flavor of our original Perf Bytes cereal without the potential for the slurred speech. Caution, Perf Bytes are not for anyone under 21 years of age. After eating Perf Bytes in the morning, it is recommended that you either take the bus, take the train, or let someone else drive you to work. And remember, start your morning off with that delicious, nutritious cereal called Perf Bytes.
I love the Perf Bytes cereal a lot. I need to do a new ad. I actually had another ad.
All right. So, James, Howard, let's get into how we can really help people just do the basic attack then for performance of streaming infrastructures. When somebody has to jump in and test streaming, is it a totally different landscape? I mean, they have to learn totally different tools or totally different different stuff? James, what do you think?
In some cases, yes. You're going to be learning new tools. You may actually switch over to some network tools that support some of these streaming protocols if you're trying to test your network infrastructure and get quality measurements on the stream. If you're trying to test the server, then you're going to be in the more traditional tools. You're going to be in like a Load Runner, which has direct hooks to, say, Windows Media Server or Real Media Server to actually request those streams. But your test tools have got to support the latest streaming protocols.
Hey, so when you're using those tools, I mean, basically what do you do? You're just basically getting what's coming out of the server, right? See how much volume the server is going to take.
Yeah. So you see, you've got two models there. One is putting the server under load for how many streams it's going to have, unicast, multicast, through relay caches and things of that nature. Or you've got, can your network take it? If it's an internal question, you're doing network redesign, then you're looking at more of a network tool, and you have the network tool actually generating the stream and clients within the tool consuming the stream to see what's going on.
See how much parallel content you're going to be able to deliver over the network. So,
yeah, you'd be using tools like Ixia or Spirent, something that's got more of a network tool test basis in that case.
Well, I think that's an essential part of tools. Like if you've never used network emulation from HP's network virtualization, which was Shunra, Howard, our old world, the idea that you're going to test streaming without some sort of network latency emulation is crazy. It's on par with mobile. You can't really effectively validate the quality of a mobile app or a streaming scenario without having good latency simulation.
Well, it wasn't just that. I mean, with the diagnostic, you know, a really important part with the diagnostic is you have to understand what the footprint's going to, you know, what type of network footprint are you putting out there with the stream?
Yeah, for a single session, and then obviously when you test under load to validate your extrapolation is calculated properly.
Because obviously what's going to happen when you're throwing a lot of content out there, pipe size will matter, and you'll begin to throttle your content as it goes through the smaller pipe.
So even learning, if you've not learned Wireshark, you should pick up Wireshark or something that can sniff. Even if you're in the Unix world, just a TCP dump to start telling you the characteristics of a given set of packets. And what kind of being able to recognize those is going to be really good. Even if you're in your normal testing tools, a Load Runner or even a Visual Studio tool and more older tools, you might be switching to a set of protocols of virtual user types or drivers that you haven't used before. And so like a streaming RTSP or the Windows Media User, I mean, these are going to be, it might be a little bit older, but the idea is it's still going to be new to you. And if you've not done these streaming, so even an existing tool, if you want to switch over and use these other drivers or protocol or virtual user types, that's going to be new as well.
Yeah, let's go. Can we talk about Wireshark for one more minute?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, Wireshark's a great tool. It's an open source sniffer. There's no excuse not to go get it, and you'll get a ton of information out of it.
And what the main things, I think, is just looking at the first few packets that come back from opening the stream. That probably in the headers, Howard, that probably tells you everything that you need to know about how it's being sent, if it's multicast versus unicast.
Absolutely.
And then also, I think you can learn a little bit. There's some things built into Wireshark, so you can start analyzing the routes and how many hops between you and the actual server, which if you emulate the real world, let's say you go through Shunra and you have the topology, you can see whether you're jumping through way too many hops, or where those real end users are, if they're over an ISDN line, if they're on a proprietary link of some sort, there should be very few hops in the stream.
Especially if you're using a CDN, right? You should be able to, as long as you know your IP addresses, you should be able to understand, you know, what the content looks like coming from your CDN. So and Mark, the reason I'm mentioning this is because you started talking about how many hops you're taking, right? Yeah. So you really how are you really serving that video out? I bet you a lot of testers don't even know about CDNs, or if they're serving video, a CDN could come into play. Yeah.
And the same fear is that if you're in a pristine kind of test lab environment without latencies and without those routes, you might end up having a false negative where you didn't find anything wrong, with the system, but in the real world, it probably wouldn't do very well. James, what do you think about some of these tools like the TrueClient and Selenium and things where people are trying to do load testing, where they're really firing up the entire browser to start and stop these streams?
I can see that with HTML5 or, you know, maybe Flex and Flash and things of that nature, but it's got a limit on scalability. I think that works well maybe for multicasted streams where you can see if you have a network problem. But for unicasted streams, you just cannot scale using a full browser. You know, what are you going to do? You're going to go to Amazon and you're going to get 10,000 workstation images for a 10,000 user streaming test. That just does not scale.
Yeah.
So at some level, you have to go to a headless client.
Yeah. And I think to Howard's point, where even if you did find a way to test at the transport layer and open the streams, you might still have a human being opening up the stream and looking at these nuanced characteristics. Is it jittery? Does it load right? Is the quality going up and down? Is it dynamic? So you
and that speaks to a weakness in some of our traditional testing tools where we're not looking at things like mean opinion score and jitter inside of a traditional tool like a Load Runner or Silk Performer or others. But on the network tools, you do see that.
Yeah. So if you're using the GUI, and a primary essence of using that GUI is just the convenience of scripting and opening a stream, well, to be honest, to generate load, almost for the majority of generating the load, you don't care really about the stream. You just want to get the load running. And then much like a GUI user approach from years ago, you'll open one real full browser end-to-end or full client end-to-end. And then you might do a human validation to look at the characteristics of how did the stream work? Did it move smoothly and that kind of stuff?
It's kind of funny that you say that, Mark, because at the end of the day, you know, a tool is not a human being.
Really?
So, you know something? I know some human beings who are tools. A tool can't do what a human being. A tool doesn't have the eye of a human being, and you know, to get the pleasure.
Exactly right. In fact, most tools I know don't have eyes at all.
They don't.
Yes.
But again, some do.
Yes. So, the one thing we sort of covered, and I want to make sure I kind of drive this home, your test plan should specify the lab you're going to test in and the topology of the network with the latency and network characteristics for WAN emulation and the routes, because that's what's really going to give you the credibility for your streaming test to actually be valid.
And let's talk about WAN emulation for a minute. I mean, there are products out there. I think choose your product, but the most important thing with the WAN emulation product besides latency is make sure you can adjust jitter, because then you can see the results of what's going to happen with jitter. The other thing too is make sure with your WANM tool that you can throttle bandwidth. Again, I was harping earlier in the show that, you know, you don't know what your, you know, the watch E is going to have from a bandwidth or pipe size perspective, right? So with your WAN emulation tools, you can actually throttle that. So you can see if Farmer Jones is in East Berthel, Iowa, and, you know, he's watching streaming on his modem, you can actually see what his experience is going to be. Then you can actually make recommendations to say, hey, you know something? We shouldn't recommend anyone with a pipe size of XYZ be watching this, because they're going to have a really miserable experience.
Be aware of the too pristine lab environment for testing streams. Howard, you bring up, you know, Iowa, where they have tornadoes. There's the twister shape in Shunra, the HP network virtualization. That's what allows you to randomize sort of routes and conditions along different routes within a topology. When you're building a test plan for streaming, it's really important to go after some of those worst case scenarios, because your CEO is not going to be happy. You know, if everything goes swimmingly perfectly, there's this thing out there called Murphy's Law. If it can go wrong, it will go wrong on the live day that you do that all hands all across the world. Or if you're a dictator in North Korea and you want to share, you know, an all hands meeting with every citizen of the country, you don't want to piss that guy off. So plan for the worst case scenario. So you have these random network conditions packet reordering, that twister. I love the twister shape. It was always really
The twister was rocking, wasn't it?
Exactly. But this is something you can do with really good WAN emulation that will disrupt these streams. The last thing is really know that workload, much like you do with other test plans for load testing. What's the number of users? Like you mentioned, Howard, the footprint of a single session, and try to come up with a model that says we should be able to support n number of sessions at each endpoint or each branch office location or different routes that you're going to be on. Be aware of how the humans are going to get the stream. Are they going to get it on a mobile device now? And is that what links are they on?
And you're going to need to involve your network engineering staff for this type of test on a higher higher need basis than you would normally for
because
an
it's more like
test.
Infrastructure than just sort of application level throw some load and find some code base bugs. This is going to be more like actual infrastructure reconfiguration for optimization. Speaking of network guys that do things like optimizing networks, one of the things we threw out there was the idea of compression. And a lot of people think compression is a panacea to all data types. And I didn't really know, thinking about streaming, if there's compression. It's if you've ever tried to compress a video or audio file, you have to completely resample it to get it, you know, to go to a compression rate. And
A lot of these codecs, like MP3, MP4, have compression built in. H.264 also has compression built in. So you have compression at the source that's building these frames going out.
Yes, and of course, compression-wise, if you ever watch Silicon Valley, you know they have the Weissman score, which was completely fictitious. You know, it had a Weissman score of something. But apparently now people are trying to create a real actual algorithm for the Weissman score, and it's gone from fiction to be real around compression.
That's frightening.
All of an HBO series. Huh?
Yeah, exactly. But if you think about HTTP or HTML getting compressed, static content and smaller things getting compressed, that it's usually really small sizes, like things that are 100K, 50K, very small pieces that can be compressed really quickly from the web origin to the client. Where streams, if you're going to do real-time streaming, typically, as you point out, James, you sort of pre-compress it as you take it from its raw, uncompressed state into the file that you're going to stream. So the compression is usually not applied in real time because the CPU overhead or the time it would take to do that, it's just too crazy to do that. So compression doesn't seem to play a huge role in real time, but it would in the, you know, like an MP4, MP3, or the actual, like you say, H.264.
Where we do have something kind of quasi-compression related is this concept of bit rate or sample rate.
Yeah.
Mark, you brought up variable bit rate recordings earlier where we could drop some number of bits in the recording and stream at a lower bit rate in order to hit a particular network target or a network quality.
Yeah.
And so this is kind of the counter to compression. We have a pre-compressed file, but it's variable bit rates. We can drop some things instead of sending them.
Funny you talk about bit rate. I was like, I knew we were going to be talking about streaming. I was looking around and I found this top five metrics to measure. And guess what was number one in the top five metrics to measure?
Bit rate.
Bit rate.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the thing to understand about sample rate or bit rate is the idea that, let's say you start your load testing around these live streams, and you find, oh my gosh, on most of the large facilities or locations where users are going to listen to the all hands meeting live from wherever, there's a few remote locations on slower links. Let's figure out how to serve a slightly lower quality to those locations so the stream can still be live.
Interesting that you mentioned that. So standard definition television typically transmitted a bit rate of 3.5 megabits, where HD can be between 8 and 15 megabits.
Yeah, and if I'm local at home with my Plex media server, I can do up to like 20 megabit. That's why it's all connected like right remotely in the house, but I'm on a proprietary local network. But the minute you throw in a little bit of latency, I think the important thing when you do see latency on those links is get a real user to sign off on the lower quality. Because if you just choose, well, let's just cut the bitrate in half, and you never really look at the end product, you should cover your assets appropriately and get some sign off that says we can do, you know, 128K, we can do 1 meg, but we can't go lower than 128 because that's just terrible in terms of the audio. Or video wise, you can't go less than 1 megabit per second. So of course
your network WAN emulation tool can help you figure that out.
Yeah. So, and then revalidate that. The other question we had, Howard, and James and I were kicking this around, was the idea of WAN acceleration. So like Cisco WAS or Riverbed, is there WAN acceleration that would affect a stream?
So do we all understand, do you think our audience understands the three major components of WAN acceleration?
Well, that's why they listen to the show, so that they can learn, Howard.
Is that my cue to explain it?
You could, in brief. We didn't think it had much to do directly with the stream data.
Well, once I explain it, you may agree that it will have nothing to do with it, right? Because
the only exception that we see is it maybe frees the pipe from requests that don't have to be handled.
The way WAN accelerator works, for those who don't know, is there are three different ways of WAN accelerator sends traffic, right? Or does things to traffic. So first thing a WAN accelerator does is compression. That's the first thing it does. It compresses all the data. The second thing your WAN accelerator is going to do is cache.
Ah, yes.
All right. And then there are three levels of caching a WAN accelerator is going to provide to you. There's the cold cache, which is just basically starting from zero, which goes to the warm cache where it learns on, you know, where it will cache most of its content. Then goes to the hot cache where it really optimizes itself, right? So unless you're streaming the video over and over and over and freaking over again, not seeing how it's going to help. The third thing is what it does is in the case of TCP, you'll get all of your handshakes going between the WAN accelerator and your local data source. And what we'll do is we'll send the data over UDP to its fellow WAN accelerator, which will then in turn do the TCP handshakes on the other side. Yeah. So not seeing how it's going to help.
Yeah. So one of the sites, obviously I follow the Riverbed guys a lot because I have guys over there, and there's a website called nojitter.com. There's a couple different postings out here that really do, James, they kind of corroborate the same thing we were saying. It does, WAN acceleration does help, but not directly. It does help indirectly. So other protocols get optimized that frees up the pipe so that higher priority streaming packets have plenty of bandwidth to get where they want to go quicker and more reliably.
So it's an indirect solution then, Mark. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah.
Yes.
In terms of optimizing things, that's probably the biggest part. Make sure you have a caching solution, which could be Squid or Riverbed, and Cisco WAS is another one. Silver Peak's another one. That's really, really good. And save as much pipe as possible for the critical streams, for VoIP, for live video conferencing, and of course, porn, for government employees, of course, right? To have nothing better to do than sit around. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right. So guys, we have covered streaming performance in a very thorough sense. We've covered a lot of the entire topic. Howard, do you have any closing thoughts on streaming?
Yes, I do. And this is for the home guys like me and guys and gals like me who like to watch their Netflix and things at home. Number one, whenever possible, at least stream your video content on a wired connection. If you watch content via, Wi-Fi, basically you're gonna get a 30% degradation off a wired connection right off the bat. But if you must watch on Wi-Fi, try and get as close to the source, the wireless router source, as possible. And also try and clear other traffic in the house. So if your kids are playing their online video games, kick them off the game. Or better yet, just wait until they go to bed so you don't have to deal with the whining.
That's right. I will give one learned thing that I had, at least for home use around streaming. I noticed that when I plugged in my Roku 3, it was only 100 meg, the connection, Now, of course, 100 meg is probably five times more than I would ever stream over Plex, but I can actually, to a wireless end, stream way more than 100 megabit. And so I actually get a little bit faster throughput on streams if I go Wi-Fi.
And I'm not saying wireless is at the end of the day, because honestly, my TV, you know, yeah. we have our smart TV in our house, and that's connected via yeah. wireless. I don't have a Cat 5 running
but
the, to
if
it.
You do local home streaming, that's at like 20 megabits, you know, that's actually a serious constant stream. Wired to Ethernet, gigabit Ethernet on a Cat 6 is not a bad idea. James, what are your thoughts here in closing?
I would say download the Darwin streaming server and just play around with it. There's some complimentary items to that. Get fiber to your house like Mark. And you won't have to worry about streaming forever.
And Howard has Fios. Fios is we're fiber.
Yes, I have fiber to my house.
I appreciate that, Howard. So if you want to improve the quality of your streaming experience in your house, as most of us do have Netflix and other solutions, get a Squid server and free up your pipe.
Do some caching on the regular stuff that you do. I was just going to say, you know, that a lot of people just are never going to encounter streaming in their general load testing. But I do see this becoming more and more common. Rich web experiences, increasingly common, media savvy type of HTML web pages and web designs. Even a normal e-commerce site now has everything is moving. Everything is streaming information. The minute you land on a page, boom, it's talking to you. It's streaming a video. So this is going to invade more and more of your traditional straightforward testing, so be ready with it. Know what kinds of questions to ask, what to plan for, right? What's the arrival rate? What's the workload? What's the topology? And also the number one thing, I think, for people testing streaming systems for companies and larger installs is really understand that your test lab is, if it's under-configured or you don't have full control over the network, get with your network guys, because this is more sophisticated. It includes a lot more details on network topology and how networking and routes work, latency emulation, and of course, don't forget single malt scotch, because you're going to be up in the middle of the night reconfiguring the routes and the WAN emulation in your lab. Well, PerfBytes listeners, once again, you've come to the close of another on-demand, no-jitter episode of PerfBytes. And as always, we'd like to thank all of you for tuning into the show today.
Oh, I want to thank my wife, the dynamic Mrs. Chorney, for all of her patience as I've been on this major, major travel tear. Love you, dear. Be home Thursday. Enjoy the snow.
Mom, thank you for listening.
Very good. As always, I will thank the sexy Irish voice of Perf Bites. And a special thanks to our great sponsors, Smart Bear and Sosta, for their sponsorship and support of the Perf Bites show and Perf Bites community. And of course, thanks to all the porn network architects out there everywhere who are helping to re-innovate streaming stuff.
Today's show is powered by developers who only test with a single thread.
All of the content of this Perf Bytes episode is copyrighted and protected by dozens of developers taking their single threads and weaving them into an impressive web of mayhem, complete with giant poisonous spiders. By the way, these spiders are programmed to attack anyone who dares to defy them and force their prey to do manual functional testing of the crappy hunk of goo that they are trying to force down the general public's throat. Then eat them after they're done.
Reminds me of that Gene Simmons movie. He was the evil guy with the little nanobot spiders.
Yeah, with Tom Selleck in it.
Tom Selleck, he was the evil nanobot spider guy.
You know, that was actually based on a Michael, I believe that was actually based on a Michael Crichton.
Michael Crichton book, yeah, that was good, yeah. Exactly. Well, for more information about the Perf Bytes, please visit the show's website at www.perfbytes.com or follow us on the Twitter and the Facebook. And of course, you can always subscribe and listen to the Perf Bytes podcast on iHeartRadio, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher, and testingpodcast.com. Just open your favorite listening app and search for Perf Bytes and click the subscribe button or favorites button or whatever frickin' button you have.
The Perf Bytes show and staff are supporters of the Practical Performance Analyst, the Performance Engineering Book of Knowledge, the Computer Measurement Group, a workshop on performance and reliability, and of course, the Software Test Professionals community of software testers. We hope to see you at the next STPCon conference. Check more out at stpcon.com.
Yeah, that should be awesome. Thank you, guys. We'll see you on the next Perf Bites.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Goodbye.